Well, following on from Andrew's series on Christology, we continue, as it were, this summer interlude before we return again to going through some of the books of Scripture. And tonight I'm beginning an examination of the subject of Islamism and Christians in the UK 2015. Beginning it, probably there's about three more sessions on it to come, as we take in something of this terrain, what a vast subject it is and of vast implication. So we're looking at the phenomenon of Islamism. So what is Islamism? Briefly put, it is a version of the Islamic faith based on a particular reading of the Quran that seeks to bring all society, including government, family life, conduct of business and religion in a given area, under the explicit control of the religious writings of the Islamic faith. It is thus a reforming and missionary enterprise that aims to implement Sharia law, in other words, the social and economic laws governing society derived from the authoritative writings of Islam. This quasi-evangelistic enterprise might be applied to an existing Muslim society. So Islamism would move to bring slack, religiously lax Muslim countries back to the true faith. Or beyond that, its ambitions and aims might be applied further afield, to bring what were once Muslim-controlled lands back under their rightful ownership again. This branch of Islamist thinking might be applied, for example, to the larger part of modern Spain, which was once under the control of the Moors, the Muslim medieval rulers, both there and in parts of Italy as well. Some of those who espouse Islamist ideology would regard it as their duty to regain these territories again and bring them under the full gamut of Islamic law and government. Thus, Islamism would regard it as an obligation for a good Muslim to work to bring these once Muslim-controlled lands back under the true religion of Islam and subject to Islamic rules. But it can go beyond this. For some entertain the even greater ambition of bringing the whole world under the rule of the Quran and the example of the Prophet Muhammad. This visionary, missionary and strongly interventionist reading of the Islamic texts has been the guiding light, for example, in the Al-Qaeda movement. It is also the motivating principle behind the more recent flowering of Islamism as represented by ISIS, Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, or ISIL, Islamic State in Iraq and Levant, or the more straightforward IS, Islamic State. Or we might render it in its Arabic equivalent, which is Daesh, or Daesh. This thinking informs the strategies of the movement troubling the Muslim-dominated northern tracts of Nigeria and neighbouring Chad, which we know as Boko Haram. It is also the philosophy governing the actions of Al-Shabaab, a Somalia-based group who have brought such trouble to Kenya. That's included, hasn't it, the Westgate Shopping Centre attack in Nairobi, which took place on September the 21st, 2013. That left 67 people dead, including the four gunmen, and 175 wounded. Islamism can include, then, the use of considerable violence and ill-treatment of people, which is something we'll be considering in detail in the course of our inquiry, as we're trying to seek to determine whether these actions are approved of in the Quran and the other religious writings of Islam or not. From the perspective of the largely secular West, Islamism is coupled together with terms such as extremist, radical, militant, jihadist, or fundamentalist. It'll be another of our tasks along the way to work out whether this qualifying language is appropriate or whether these groups are simply implementing a version of the Islamic faith that can actually be justified from their holy texts. In other words, is the actual Islamism itself, strictly speaking, not to be viewed as an aberrant and deviant form of Islam, but rather, is it a perfectly valid expression of this so-called Abrahamic world faith? The answers may not make for comfortable listening, but they need to be answered if we're going to get anywhere near understanding the phenomenon we're calling Islamism and which we are beginning to consider today. My first heading, the steps we're going to follow. Well, those introductory comments made. Next, we're going to look at why we should be concerned about this phenomenon and seek to understand it. There are some pretty obvious reasons we could give, but there are some further ones that are especially relevant to us as Christians. These are especially important for us as Christians in Britain 2015. That's going to take up some of our time this evening. What does this all add up to? What are the issues that it raises for us here in the UK and as Christians in particular? Next, we want to gain some background about, among other things, the life of Muhammad, the prophet of Islam, and also the writings that give prominence or have prominence in the Islamic faith and which govern their practice. Well, this is no small undertaking. There are schools given over to understanding Islamic thought and working out what the duties of Muslims are as written in the Quran. But we're going to try nevertheless, because it is important that we do. People, including a number of Christians, are dying and suffering because of the answers that different people are arriving at in response to this issue. Likewise, our own country could become increasingly the subject of terrorist action in response to the conclusion that some people in the world are reaching regarding this question. A lot hinges on it. Next, and this will be in future weeks again, we'll carry forward the findings of this to look in more detail at the present-day manifestations of Islamism and to see what lies behind their foundation and their actions. I hope to show that the behaviour of groups like IS, sadly, is quite logical and a reasoned set of actions based upon evidence-based premises. We'll then go on to make some points about Islamism in the UK today and try to set ourselves the goal of understanding it more carefully. How strong is it? Where is it heading? How does it affect us as Christians? And finally, we'll look at some of the implications, what this means for believers today. What can we learn about ourselves? What does it teach us about our relationship to the Lord? How does it help us to read our text, the Bible, better? And how can we serve the Lord better through what we learn about the phenomenon we're calling Islamism? So those are the steps we're going to follow. Well, my next heading is this. Reasons for looking at the phenomenon in the first place. Reasons for looking at the phenomenon in the first place. Well, on the face of it, it is very easy to justify some examination of Islamism in today's world. Well, we know the media are notoriously fickle in the issues they choose to report and in their attention span once they've started to report them. That is true. But we are forced to agree that the amount of airtime and column inches devoted in today's media to happenings in Iraq, Syria, Libya, Nigeria, to name a few places, is perfectly justified. Indeed, we would justly make the criticism that the media have not, on the whole, reported the situation in the Islamic world enough over the last, say, 50 years or so. For example, Christians have been suffering at the hands of Muslims in scores of Islamic countries, and this has barely been commented on in the mainstream media. But that is now changing. Today there is far more attention being given to the treatment of Christians and other minority faiths in Muslim-majority countries than certainly there was, say, 5 years ago. The actions of Al-Qaeda, but particularly of IS, have guaranteed that this would be so. the sheer brutality of IS, if for no other reason, has forced the issue of Islamism upon the attention of the world at large. Everyone is sitting up and paying attention. It is being realized that everything connected to the emergence of IS has a global dimension, as well as a strong UK public interest component. The huge numbers of people and countries that have been caught up in the problem are staggering. The evils that have been committed against people in these conquered lands are utterly abhorrent and shocking. The prospect for further populations becoming embroiled in this tragedy is potentially epic in proportions. The refugee problem associated with these current events dwarfs in terms of its scale many other international catastrophes, serious though these all have been. Our own country's exposure to the pressures of that refugee problem, coupled to the wider issue of immigration into this country, illegal or otherwise, from what are often Muslim-majority countries, is a very live question. The danger to our own military personnel as a result of British military intervention, both now and possibly in a more significant way in the future, is a pressing and real matter of concern. Then, allied to these concerns, is the whole matter of how the appetite among British Muslims for Islamist-type options may change in the future in the light of events in the Middle East. This must include the reaction of Muslim people in the UK to further British military intervention in the affected zones. The flight of some people from the UK, involving both men and women, sometimes including young families and vulnerable teenage girls to ally themselves with IS, is already newsworthy. From jihadi brides to returning IS war veterans bent on committing terrorist offences on British soil, all of this is something that merits the recognition it is receiving in the media and from government. We might add, with a wry smile, that the front runner in the Labour leadership election, Jeremy Corbyn, has made eyebrows rise with some of the radical Islamic company he has kept, and with some of his comments, for example, comparing the actions of IS with the US-led 2003 intervention in Iraq. So, the IS story links with lots of other stories of huge topical interest and importance. So, first set of reasons, but now my next heading, some necessary detail. Let us add some flesh to these comments by outlining some of the eye-catching details connected with current events in the Middle East and elsewhere. At the moment, then, IS is in control of considerable parts of Syria and Iraq, including such key cities as Mosul in Iraq and Al-Raqqa in Syria. Estimates vary wildly as to how many IS supporters there are in each country, or these affected countries. Kurdish estimates put their number as high as 200,000. IS itself claims to have between 40 to 60,000 soldiers, supporters in Iraq and Syria. The CIA gives a more sober estimate and puts it at between 20 to 31,000. Worldwide, when one includes all those others across the world, such as in Nigeria, who are acting under the IS flag, the number stands at between, 52,600 and 257,900. So the estimates fluctuate wildly, but there is no underestimating what they are achieving militarily. In terms of land controlled, their holdings are very impressive, with much of the northwest of Iraq in their grip. Needs to be remembered, however, that much of that territory is actually desert. But it is a testimony to the efficiency of its military leadership and its accompanying foot soldiers, plus we must add testimony to the incompetence of those charged with defending those areas. Mosul, Iraq's third largest city, fell to IS on June the 10th, 2014. Once a city of 2.5 million people, some 500,000 people were reported to have fled within 2 days of the occupation. in Syria, with the fall of the ancient city of Palmyra. A report in The Guardian for May the 21st quotes the Syrian Human Rights Organization as estimating that 50% of Syria's landmass is now under IS control, amounting to some 95,000 square kilometers. Well, if IS's territorial possessions are sometimes more modest when put under the microscope, its behavior when in possession of those areas has been attention-grabbing, on account of the sheer brutality of its soldiers and governance. Reuters reported on May the 18th this year that in capturing the Iraqi city of Ramadi, 500 civilians were killed by IS and 8,000 fled their homes. This was in addition to a staggering 114,000 who had already fled in the run-up to the invasion of this particular town. As a report on July the 23rd in the Christian Post stated, since their emergence, the radical group has displaced, tortured, raped and killed more than 4 million Arabs and other minority groups, including many women and children. The group's notoriety for killing helpless civilians is widespread, and the group is infamous for persecuting religious minority groups, including Christians, Shiite Muslims, Yazidis and Turkmen. The same article also stated that more than 4 million Iraqi and Syrian refugees are seeking to escape the clutches of IS. Well, the figures are mind-boggling. As mentioned, reports regularly surface of, for example, men in these conquered communities being marched out and shot. We learn of women and children traded as sex slaves. There have been the appalling beheadings of Western Aid workers and reporters. Church properties have been destroyed, and Christians, among others, have suffered appalling and humiliating treatment. The beheading of the 21 kidnapped Egyptian Christians in the IS-controlled part of Libya has been one such instance. The butchery, cruelty, inhumanity, greed, lust, depravity, and pure evil have been on an industrial scale. Words fail us to describe them in their true colours. These acts have forced IS into the public domain and compelled us to recognise their existence. Well, next, Homeland Security. Homeland Security. Another very practical matter is that these people constitute a very real threat to people from our own country. Foreign tourists have been identified as soft targets for IS sympathisers wanting to exact revenge for Western airstrikes against IS installations in Iraq and Syria. 38 tourists died in the shootings in the Tunisian resort of Sousse on June the 26th, including 30 British nationals. Tunisia was also host to another terrorist attack on March the 18th this year in the city of Tunis, when the Bardo Museum was attacked, leaving 19 foreign tourists dead, including one Briton, in addition to a Tunisian policeman and one Tunisian national. IS claimed responsibility, although this has been disputed by the Tunisian authorities. IS has also made threats against people in the UK. For example, Sky News released some disturbing information on Tuesday, August 11th, just a few weeks ago. An undercover freelance reporter working with Sky News posed as a wannabe jihadist, using both the female and male alias. Through social media and Twitter, the reporter soon got some very interesting takers for his bait. According to Sky News, I report, the online posts by our characters over the past 4 months attracted the attention of two major players in Islamic State's so-called cyber caliphate. One of them is Junaid Hussein, a 21-year-old hacker turned jihadist from Birmingham, who runs the IS information and recruitment arm from Syria. He has been identified by the US Secret Service as a top 5 target for elimination by drone strike. His wife, Sally Jones, a former punk from Chatham, Kent, is also in Syria alongside Hussein in Raqqa, but dealing with female IS-supporting jihadists. Well, what did the reporter learn? The Sky News article goes on. From the start, it became clear that IS wants its recruits to attack the UK and not to travel to their so-called caliphate. Sending us detailed guidebooks, they urged our fictional characters to form gangs and to create a British Islamic State over a long period. Another long march through the institutions, isn't it, there? Well, through these contacts, it emerged that there was a plan to commit an attack at the VJ, Victory in Japan celebrations, that were going to be attended by the Queen. According to the contacts the reporter had made, there were four or five British IS-trained terrorists who had been sent back to the UK to commit acts of terror. Sally Jones, now known as Hussein, had also divulged in her conversation that there were some British people she was in touch with who were interested in committing acts of terror, including a would-be bomber in Scotland. There are an estimated 300 jihadi fighters who have made their way back to the UK after being in Iraq and Syria. So the threat to UK nationals, both at home and overseas, should not be underplayed. Well, now, thinking as Christians. My next heading, thinking as Christians. But there are more reasons than simple newsworthiness that warrant us spending some time looking at the phenomenon of Islamism. We as Christians are especially called upon to consider these matters and give them our special attention. This is for a number of reasons. First of all, and again very obviously, many of the people who are suffering firsthand from the brutality of IS are Christians. This is actually being recognised increasingly in the media and is a matter that has been raised in Parliament. We are compelled to follow the story because IS has a policy towards Christians which it believes is mandated in the Quran and elsewhere in ancient Islamic literature. Consider again the reading that accompanies our considerations. Psalm 79 seems so much to fit into the context of the place of the believer under the murderous invasion of IS. Let's read the first four verses again of Psalm 79. O God, the nations have come into your inheritance. Your holy temple they have defiled. They have laid Jerusalem in heaps. The dead bodies of your servants they have given as food for the birds of the heavens, the flesh of your saints to the beasts of the earth. Their blood they have shed like water all around Jerusalem, and there was no one to bury them. We have become a reproach to our neighbours, a scorn and derision to those who are around us. Remember, we're to think of Old Testament references that they are realised in the New Covenant reality of the Church. The nations of verse 1 stands for the world of Islam as much as for anywhere else. They do lay the Church, Jerusalem, in heaps. How poignant that the psalmist sees the dead bodies of the people given as food to the birds of heaven and to the beasts of the field. That same neglect of decent burial and respect for the dead is symptomatic of IS's dealings with people in its captured territories, including its Christian inhabitants. Their blood they have shed like water all around Jerusalem. That sums it up. The attacks of IS on the church fits within this element of the teaching of the Word of God. Furthermore, looking back at Sister Psalm number 74, the similarities with contemporary events are chilling. Consider in Psalm 74, verses 3 to 4, the enemy damaging everything in the sanctuary and roaring in the meeting places. The attacks on church property have been the ways of God's enemies through the ages. See also in verse 4 how they set up their banners. The black and white flag of IS bearing the insignia of Muhammad, which so many of the jihadists tote, harks back to the Babylonian storming of Jerusalem and the banners they sported. Axes, hammers, fires and defilement are the places where the Lord's people meet. It's the same territory that the psalmist saw and lamented. This is the ground that the Bible covers. These are the actions of inveterate enemies of the Lord's people through the ages. We need to pay special attention to it. It is spiritually very close to home. So we stare these sufferings fully in the face. We want to know. We need to know. We identify with these people. Remember the prisoners as if chained with them. Those who are mistreated, since you yourselves are in the body also. Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 3. Though many of the people affected, we have to admit, are nominal Christians, others are not. They are of the household of faith. Those Psalms 74 and 79 lay out for us heartfelt prayers. O God, how long will the adversary reproach? Will the enemy blaspheme your name forever? Psalm 74, verse 10. Arise, O God, plead your own cause. Remember how the foolish man reproaches you daily. Psalm 74 again, verse 22, and then Psalm 79, verses 11 to 12. Let the groaning of the prisoner come before you. According to the greatness of your power, preserve those who are appointed to die, and return to our neighbours sevenfold into their bosom their reproach with which they have reproached you, O Lord. This is where we find ourselves. The sufferings of the people in the Middle East have a special claim on our attention because there is a strongly religious dimension to all that is happening. It affects the Christian church, and therefore it affects us most profoundly. On the next heading, further considerations for Christians. There are other questions that are also of great interest to us as Christians. The whole issue of the Islamic faith is again before us. 9/11 forced us to think about it, as we did on our first evenings 13 or so years ago. IS has made the same inquiry imperative again. Since then, the presence of Islam in the UK has only grown. There are, according to the 2011 census, 2.78 million Muslims resident in the UK. Of these, the vast majority are in England, amounting to some 5% of the English population. 10 years previously, it stood at about 3%. Well, they may not live in Crich, but they live in cities not too far from us. They live in towns and cities where many people we know are pastors or active church members. Come to that, we never know when we might meet Muslims in the course of our travels. Oh, that one I met, wasn't there, the other week, in a taxi in Bolton. When all is said and done, they, all of them, Islamic people, whether abroad or here at home, are our neighbours, and we're called upon to love them, and to whom we are mandated to take the gospel. So it very much helps to know what their present-day attitudes might be towards the gospel message, and towards us as its representatives. So the question forces itself upon us in the context of our evangelistic work about the Quran and the other authoritative Islamic writings and what they have to say about us, about Christ, about the Bible, and about the Christian faith in general. It will help in our evangelism to know. It will help us in our duty to pray for them also. Then again, in thinking about Islam, we are inquiring into an area of a special interest to us as spiritual people. Those who practice Islam, stripping it down to its component parts, are engaged in an intellectual, moral, and spiritual pursuit, involving beliefs about the person and being of a higher power, about creation, our purpose, our duties to this higher supernatural being, the way of salvation, the correct approach to serving him, to name just a few things. All these are matters of intense interest and concern to both us and Muslims, even if they do not excite the interest of large swathes of our secular neighbours. Islam makes truth statements about an invisible, supernatural being. They make assertions about his character, what pleases him, how he is to be known, and the place of Muhammad as a claimed recipient of revelation from this deity. This is of great interest to us. we take seriously matters to do with inspired texts and the Word of God. We're interested in matters to do with the soul and our relationship with God. We do not agree with Muslims. We do not agree with the Islamic faith. But we are challenged by them and provoked to look at ourselves carefully and not shirk this duty. We do not have the exclusive rights to claims about invisible, divine, supernatural beings. And we need to be able to stare Islam straight in the face and rise above its claims. We do not want to be too afraid to undertake self-examination. Furthermore, we are confident, aren't we, that our beliefs and the grounds for what we believe and do are, putting it bluntly, superior to those advanced by Islam. So we do not want to be superficial in our analysis or our response. We want to be thorough. The militant atheists are looking on. So are quite a few others in the governing classes. Many of them very much believe that we as Christians are unable to distinguish ourselves from Islam or indeed Islamism. Their conviction is influencing their policy and lawmaking with potentially huge ramifications for the future and our liberties and the rights to express our religion. We need to be able to carefully distinguish ourselves from Islam and to do it in a way that is coherent and convincing. Taking this further, my next heading, thinking for ourselves. Let us take this line of thinking a little further. There's something here that is very important for our young people. It is the need for rigorous, independent thinking. We have said that Islamism has generated a huge amount of interest and comment, not just from Muslims or Christians. People of all faiths and none are offering their own interpretations of what is happening in the world of the Islamic faith, and also chancing their arm at offering a few thoughts about the Christian faith for good measure. Explanations for contemporary events abound, and these intrude into areas that are very much our preserve. Whether it is Islam or us as Christians, we are being put under the microscope by policymakers or by people who have the ear of such people. Prime ministers, would-be prime ministers, editors of national newspapers, writers of books, broadcasters and teachers in the classroom are all trying to establish a framework to understand religion in general and Islam in particular. Islamism has only put this process into overdrive. We all of us, our young people most especially, need to be able to be part of this debate because this discussion is shaping the legal, intellectual, and moral terrain of British society and culture. Freedom of speech and our freedom to practice our faith without being penalised or criminalised by the law are just a few of the matters that are at stake. As the Apostle Peter told the people of his day, "Therefore gird up the loins of your minds, be sober, and rest your hope fully upon the grace that is to be brought to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ." 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 13. Be sober. Gird up the loins of your minds. We need to be thinking. Or as Paul warned us in Ephesians chapter 6, verses 10 to 13, "Finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might. Put on the whole armour of God, that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. For do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. Therefore take up the whole armour of God, that you may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all, to stand." So it's all part of something much bigger. We cannot go around naively with our heads in the clouds. It is a time for the exercise of what we have been given by way of faith, righteousness, and our salvation. Next heading, a confused debate. A confused debate. The need for sober thinking and spiritual resources is nowhere more glaringly obvious than when we see just how difficult it is to think clearly and rigorously on these issues. There are any number of factors that interfere with us being able to evaluate dispassionately and respond reasonably and proportionately. Truth and factual information have a number of hurdles to get over in order to come into our possession, and once there, a further set of hurdles to surmount before they can be acted upon. What do I mean? Well, one of the difficulties is that the quest for understanding and the desire to reach firm, clear, and rigorous conclusions can be a very hazardous enterprise. Putting it crudely, it has cost people their lives. And when the stakes are as high as that, it can often seem the more prudent policy to let facts remain quietly buried and to leave things unsaid. Many Muslims in the West are very sensitive to any criticism of the tenets of their faith or challenges to the authority and integrity of Muhammad. Those in Muslim-majority countries are even more sensitive. Riots, angry denunciations, and even revenge killings are some of the observed outcomes when criticism is ventured against the practices and beliefs of Muslims, and in particular the practices and beliefs of its founder, Muhammad. Liberal Muslims risk much when they speak out. In the United States, a Muslim lecturer called Yazir Qadi receives death threats for his carefully stated and properly argued views against the violent jihadist narrative of IS. An ex-extremist himself, but still zealous for the Quran and the promotion of piety among Muslims, he is now at the Religious Studies Department of Rhodes College in Memphis, Tennessee. But even his comments from a conservative Muslim viewpoint have still led to threats being made against him. Pre-inquiry, investigation, and reasoned comment does not always get reciprocated in kind by those who are critiqued. Emails, letters, and essays are not the weapons of choice for some, more the bullet, bomb, sword, or machete. It is not a good environment for the conduct of free inquiry and the forming of judgments when this could lead to serious consequences to oneself or one's own family. For example, on September 30th, 2005, the Danish broadsheet, the Jyllands Posten or Jutland Post, published 12 cartoons depicting aspects of Islamic life, including the Prophet Muhammad, as part of a cultural piece on freedom of speech and censorship. The effect was dramatic. There were immediate protests from the Danish Muslim population. This led to a complaint being lodged with the police that triggered an investigation to see if the law had been broken through the publication of these cartoons. The complaint was not upheld. So a group of leading Danish clerics then took their campaign to the wider Muslim world, with a tour of Muslim-majority countries in late January and early February 2006 to drum up opposition to the cartoons. 11 ambassadors from different Muslim countries sought to meet the Danish Prime Minister to voice their unhappiness. The visit of the clerics sparked protests in many countries, including here in the UK, with a demonstration outside the Danish embassy in London. There were boycotts of Danish products, and it is estimated by the New York Times that in excess of 200 people died in the ensuing uproar as offended Muslims sought vengeance on behalf of the Prophet. The chief cartoonist at the paper, Kurt Vestergaard, is still in hiding to this day and under police protection, as are other members of staff at the Jutland Post. When Danish-born Jutta Clausen, professor at Brandeis University, located just outside Boston, Massachusetts, sought to have a scholarly review of this incident published, entitled The Cartoons That Shook the World, Yale University Press would only publish the book if it omitted the cartoons out of fear for the safety of their staff. Then this year, there were the January the 7th attacks on the Paris offices of the French satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo, which left 11 of its staff plus one policeman dead. They had previously republished the cartoons themselves, plus some other satirical material of their own. Two brothers, claiming to be part of Al-Qaeda in Yemen, carried out the attacks, the magazine staff, plus those at the Jutland Post, being cited on a most wanting list issued by the parent organisation Al-Qaeda. Well, now as Christians, we would have been offended if Christ had been represented in this satirical format, and would have been moved to respond. The cartoons were below the belt. There's plenty that can be said from the historical record regarding the life of Muhammad in sober and well-documented prose without resorting to ridicule or the use of a medium, in other words cartoons, that are more suited to a polemical and provocative style of argument. The reaction from the Muslim world showed how little room for manoeuvre there is for those wishing to make a negative statement about the founder of the Islamic faith. If reason lectures incur death threats, then there was never much hope for the Danish cartoons going down quietly. It must be therefore borne in mind that negative material about Islam has some hurdles to overcome before it is going to reach the public domain. So when we attempt to make some judgment about the situation regarding Muslim influence in today's society, including their attitude towards Christians, we are operating in an environment where it is not always easy to get at the facts. And we do well to remember this. Those who are offering to tell us what is happening may not always be telling it as it is. For example, comment from politicians about the Muslim faith is liable to be toned down so as not to inflame Muslim opinion. Information about unhelpful aspects of Islamic life are likely to be played down so as not to alarm people or play into the hands of extremists like the British National Party, the BNP. Truth has another battle to fight before it can emerge. If there is information that is negative about the role of Islam in society, it is liable to be strangled before it sees the light of day. Bearers of tidings like these risk being labelled Islamophobic or closet racists. So if the Islamists don't get you with a knife, then the secular, politically correct left will get you instead with their own assassin's bullet, that you are a diseased carrier of Islamophobia. Truth has a battle on its hands to get heard in this environment. There's a long and torturous journey to make before it can escape these different strangleholds and reach the public domain. So in this highly charged environment, it can be difficult to arrive at the facts, but it is vital that we try. So some examples. One clear example of unhelpful facts being withheld from the public domain emerged a year and a half ago. Birmingham City Council knew of the involvement of Muslim extremists in the running of city schools. It did not act, however, until someone blew the whistle and went over the city authorities' head by leaking to the media the contents of the so-called Trojan Horse letter. This missive was a kindly word of advice from a group of Islamic fundamentalists in Birmingham to some friends in Bradford, setting out some helpful guidelines on making your local state school compliant with the expectations of the radical Islamic agenda. It set out what had been achieved in Birmingham itself and offered a plan of action for those wanting to repeat the process elsewhere. The letter had been sat on by both the City Council and the Department for Education, but then it got leaked. The BBC and a number of other media outlets carried the story on March 7, 2014. It created uproar. Were these things actually happening in state schools in our country? Were children being exposed to some of the most extremist kinds of Muslim thought and practice? It led to immediate investigations by a number of agencies, including the school's inspectorate, Ofsted. But, as if to warn just how hazardous it is to get hard currency information regarding Islamic belief and practice in the UK, both The Guardian and The Independent newspapers carried pieces on June 7, 2014, repeating sympathetically the view held by some that the letter was an amateurish hoax. The Guardian piece by Richard Adams looked on in a state of bemusement at the frenzied activity of the government and its various agencies. And all of this in response to a fake letter. He hoped it would not unleash a witch hunt against, one presumes, some well-meaning Islamic school governors or the supporters of multiculturalism. People like Adams were probably hoping for some future disclosure that would reveal the identity of the letter's author as the BNP type. Hopefully, too, the establishment will give itself away in the process and turn out to be one of the nastiest cases of Islamophobia witnessed in these aisles. If they were hoping for their Hercule Poirot-like moment to come when they could unmask the true villains, they were to be disappointed. Birmingham City Council confirmed the letter was no hoax, but was real. The Guardian and the Independent had themselves become part of the problem, setting up hurdles in the way of finding out the truth and introducing confusion rather than clear thinking. The City Council conceded they had been aware of growing radical Islamic influence for 20 years. It appeared they had suppressed information prejudicial to the multicultural cause from coming into the public domain, in the hope of sustaining the positive message about Muslim involvement in society and avoiding the wounding charge of being Islamophobic. The truth was the casualty, and we were kept in the dark about some of the things that were going on out there. And we could have looked at various other matters under this heading, extremist preachers on university campuses, the Rotherham child abuse scandal, or mayoral elections in Tower Hamlets. But we must conclude today's considerations. All of this is intensely important. It's rather worrying, isn't it, that out of this weird and chaotic environment, where facts and truths struggle to escape the stranglehold of political correctness and the like, laws and policy are being made which have great implications for us as Christians. The fact-starved and truth-light world that most of us are condemned to live in when it comes to Islam in the UK, is now working against us. In the name of preventing the rise of some none too clearly defined extremism, we as Christians face having extremist disruption orders slapped on us to shut us down in the public square. Well, whatever these extremist Muslims are about, we're forced to conclude from this policy response that we must be just as bad. Then, the ultimate in high treason, the failure to support British values, has also been fashioned out to the smoke and mirrors world of the debate about Islam. What lies at the heart of British values? Why, it is obvious. Support for gay marriage and same-sex relationships. From the Trojan horse letter incident, the one clear conclusion to come out is that the greatest threat to our nation's well-being and the cohesiveness of our society is the failure to teach in our schools the immense value of the apparently, innately, British virtue of homosexuality. We know, because the first school to die the traitor's death was a Christian ethos school in the northeast of England. Minister Nicky Morgan dispatched it to its fate, having been dead to calls for clemency and having concluded that the removal of these homophobic traitors left our country a safer place for our children. When facts regarding Islamic extremism in schools have been mangled, strangled, massaged, forgotten, suppressed, and blended with equally mangled, strangled, massaged, forgotten, and suppressed facts about the Christian faith, to yield this particular result, how this all happened, we will never know. But one thing is clear. The debate about Islam, where truth has to overcome so many hurdles before it can be properly heard or acted upon, is bearing down on evangelical Christians in Britain 2015. Islamism, whether we care to admit it or not, has huge implications for the future of evangelicalism in the UK. So next week, we will try to understand a little more clearly about the life of Muhammad, the founder of the religion, and at some of the things that he did and that he taught.